This month, Stuart, we are talking about first trimester, i.e. pregnant vaginal bleeding. How do you feel about that?
I feel fantastic about that. I feel fantastic about vaginal bleeding. And I'll tell you why, because it's such a complete refreshing new thing, right? We've been talking about all these hardcore
cardiopulmonary issues. Yeah,
this is like a lovely change. I think it's a lovely bleed.
It's a lovely issue. And the fact that you'll never have to go through it is a good thing.
Yeah, that's why I'm so happy. Yeah, exactly.
That's the real reason why you like it. But it is common. It is just as bread and butter as chest pain and shortness of breath. So it's something that we really have to be quite astute on. What do you think?
Yeah, we're going to just focus on patients that are not visibly pregnant. You know, they're really first trimester vaginal bleeding. And we're not going to talk about the ones that are obviously pregnant. They come in gravid and they're bleeding. Those go straight to OB in most centers. Mm-hmm. It's a scary subject.
It is, yeah.
But it's a subject for a little bit of a different day. And also patients that are postpartum, right? If you know that if someone comes in, I just had a case like this, Mies, last week where it was 2 weeks that this woman was postpartum and she had a normal decrease in flow after her delivery. Uh-huh. And all of a sudden she came in with massive hemorrhage 2 weeks later. And so if you know that
they're
postpartum.
That's really delayed,
But still it falls into that category of not what we're kind of talking about today. But we have no shortage of patients that fall into the category of first trimester bleeding. And I've often joked that we work at a level one vag bleed center.
We work at a level one lot of things center, liver.
But everyone says that, right? Because everyone has a ton of these cases.
That's true. All right. So speaking of rules, rule number one, all women are pregnant until proven otherwise.
I like that how you say speaking of rules. I wasn't speaking of rules. But okay, that is an important rule when you're talking about someone who's got a vag bleed is it really comes down to the pregnancy test right away, straight off the bat. And that's something that needs to happen in the triage area, in the front area of wherever you're working, or up front. We need to have that.
So you're right, Stuart. Step one is that everyone gets a urine pregnancy test right in triage, right up front, especially if they're coming in with abdominal pain and or vaginal bleeding.
And what if they say they can't pee, Mies?
Well, then
help me out here, because nothing is worse than, you know, a patient has been with you for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And you don't know if you're going down the pregnant or non-pregnant algorithm. And it really is such a critical cutoff in our thinking that I don't want to wait. So I'm going to do something to get that test.
Our nurses are pretty good about it. But you hand them a bottle of water, you hand them a cup of water, and you say, I need pee.
And don't mix these two bottles.
And right? I need it now. But, you know, that does bring up a point that too dilute of urine can also cause a false negative. So these are pretty sensitive. 99.4%, I think, is the sensitivity for point of care urine pregnancy tests.
Right.
And it corresponds to a beta HCG of about 10 to 50. It's pretty low. But if you're over dilute with your urine, it can create a false negative.
I'm so insistent on this pregnancy testing because, you know, for many years at the very beginning of my practice, we didn't have really good bedside pregnancy tests like we have now, accurate, fast, easy to do. You know, this is something that was just being developed when I was going through medical school. At first, it was a very cumbersome process with many different bottles. I remember having to, you know, put solution A on solution B and wait 10 minutes. And then if you screwed it up, you had to start over again. And, you know, before that, you know, at the time when I was born, when, you know, my mom went into the doctor, to the OB, they used to say, oh, I'm sure you're pregnant. And they weren't, and she wasn't. And they'd say, oh, I'm sure you're not pregnant. You know, they'd look at the cervix to see what color it was and how, you know. So now that we have this amazingly accurate test, and it's so critical in management, it kills me when we don't have that to deal with, because it does make such a difference. That's all. So, and if you do, you know, if you can't get it from the urine, you can get it from the blood. You can, and that's even more accurate, right? That's even more sensitive.
Now, at the risk of destroying the flow here, we've got to talk a little bit about the pregnancy test, right? We could talk for hours about it because it is fascinating. The history of the pregnancy test is full of myth and charlatans and wonder. It's pretty cool. But we've got to talk about the rabbit test. So the rabbit test was around until not that long ago, like in my parents' lifetimes. If you were suspected to be pregnant, you could go in and get this biologic test, which was you take the urine from a suspected pregnant woman, you inject it into a rabbit, the HCG from that urine, if the woman is pregnant, gets absorbed into the rabbit, then you open up the rabbit a couple of days later, you look at the ovaries and see if they've got big follicles. You know, you assume that the rabbit wasn't pregnant before. It was supposedly pretty accurate, like really accurate, like 90% accurate or more, 98% accurate even. And it's been seen in popular culture and shows like MASH and Billy Crystal and all these things. And the euphemism for whether you were pregnant or not was the rabbit is dead or they killed the rabbit. And this was the idea that if you were pregnant, then the rabbit was dead. But in fact, whether you were non-pregnant, the rabbit was dead. Because even though they could do surgery where they open up the little rabbit and they look at the little ovaries and they could sew the rabbit back up and the rabbit didn't have to die, they didn't bother with that because it was too much of a hassle. So if you got a pregnancy test, you killed the rabbit either way. But the euphemism was the rabbit is dead, or they killed the rabbit was your pregnancy positive. I'm just saying, I find it interesting. Modern pregnancy tests are incredibly accurate, but they're nowhere near as interesting as mum and dad's pregnancy test. And so the real point of emphasis here, and it's kind of stupid because it's so obvious, is that you must get an early pregnancy test. You must. I can't tell you how many times we've gone deep into a resuscitation of a sick woman, only later to find that she's pregnant. You've got to find that out at the beginning. If you're not doing that, you're making a bit of an error.
So Stuart, as we always do, let's nail down our differential diagnosis. We're talking, like you said, about first trimester vaginal bleeders. And we really need to be worried about two diagnoses, right?
The two big players here by far are, number one, ectopic pregnancy. Any woman who presents with bleeding and or pain in early pregnancy, you need to think about ectopic. And the other big player is spontaneous abortions. And we're going to go into a little bit of detail on the different types, but those are the two huge players. And there's a bunch of other little things, but that's really how I think we should be thinking. Rule out ectopic, number one, and spontaneous abortion, number two. And then that approach will take us where we need to go.
And one of the fundamental concepts in first trimester bleeding is rule out ectopic pregnancy. Basically, everybody is rule out ectopic pregnancy until proven otherwise, because ectopic pregnancies obviously are very dangerous and bleed a lot and still kill people, much less than they used to, but still they do. And so one of the things you would do is after you've diagnosed pregnancy, you would then locate the pregnancy. And if the pregnancy was in the uterus, you were done. You've ruled out ectopic pregnancy. Might be one of these other things, but that's fine. We've ruled out ectopic pregnancy. Now, that's great, and that's true almost all the time, except this circumstance.
And Stuart, one type of ectopic pregnancy that is really rare but should be mentioned is called a heterotopic pregnancy. And these occur usually in patients who've had some sort of quote assisted conception. What do I mean by that? So intrauterine insemination or IVF or ovulation medications or stimulants. And these are patients that will have both an intrauterine pregnancy and an ectopic simultaneously. There's a couple other diagnoses we'll just throw in there. So implantation bleeding, that's usually pretty minor. Subchorionic hemorrhage, which is actually pretty common. That can be anywhere from mild to moderate bleeding. And then non-pregnancy related bleeding, right?
So yeah, you can of course, you're not off the hook for anything else. So they could have a bleeding disorder. They might have a vaginal tear, cervical cancer. And we're going to get into those more in the next episode when we talk about non-pregnant vag bleeding, but you're still on the hook for those. And those still are kind of in the background. Exactly.
So for the undifferentiated woman then, Stuart, who comes in and they're in shock and you're concerned about ruptured ectopic versus a spontaneous miscarriage or abortion, how do you differentiate those two right off the bat?
Well, I have a great way of thinking about this, which is that, you know, we're talking about people bleeding to death here, and there's two types of bleeding. In the case of the patients with the spontaneous abortion, you've got a woman who has something in the uterus that the body is trying to expel. Mm-hmm. And in the process of, you know, doing that, and sometimes that thing, that product of conception gets stuck, there's a lot of hemorrhage associated with that. That's external hemorrhage. It's visible hemorrhage. It's panicking to anyone experiencing it.
Vaginally.
They're exsanguinating. You see it. And it's a very straightforward, obvious emergency. If you want to think about it as the opposite of ectopic pregnancy, people with ectopic pregnancy sometimes present as bleeding, but they're not hemorrhaging through their vagina. Mm-hmm. They're just bleeding a little bit because there's a decidual reaction. There's a little bit of reaction that happens in the uterus with the hormones of pregnancy that the ectopic pregnancy is generating.
But where they are hemorrhaging is
they are
internally.
Is internally potentially, is because they might rupture a tube and you won't see it. And so if you want to think about it, is people can actually die from hemorrhage from a spontaneous abortion if they're bleeding on the outside, and they can die when they present with vag bleeding with an ectopic, but they're bleeding really on the inside. I mean, just sort of a way to think about it.
I like that a lot. So let's first hone in on ectopic pregnancy, because it still occurs in about 2% of pregnancies. And do you know, Stuart, that it still is the leading cause of maternal death in the first trimester? That's pretty alarming.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know that there's so much that has advanced, and ultrasound is the huge one.
Yeah.
But what I had seen these patients succumb to this, I've seen patients die of ruptured ectopic in the beginning of my practice. In the first few years, I saw a few cases, and I haven't seen it for some time, because if they do get to us in time, we know how to resuscitate
them. We do. Yeah. The tricky thing with these ladies is that for the most part, they're young and healthy. So they will compensate for quite a while. They might be slightly tachycardic, but they might look pretty darn good. And they'll be walking around with a couple liters of blood in their belly. So really having a high index of suspicion is super important. So rule number one was all women are pregnant until proven otherwise. Rule number two is that all pregnant women have an ectopic until proven otherwise. And I think, like you said, that point of care ultrasound is a huge, huge game changer. Stick a probe straight on the belly right when they come in, and you can just quickly assess if there's free fluid or not. So Stuart, our clinical approach for these unstable pregnant vaginal bleeders is really going to be the same. Like we always do, let's quickly talk about our initial approach to these patients.
First thing is, I think you need to get some sort of access on them. If they're pretty stable, that might just be a simple IV, doesn't have to be huge. If there's any question about instability, obviously you're going to be going for your standard two large bore IVs. You're going to be really aggressive. Reasonable to put them on a monitor, Mies, and get a pulse ox. I think those are very reasonable things. Just a comment about the vital signs is that you might see some tachycardia. If they're hemorrhaging, that might be a sign of instability. You might see hypotension. I mean, those are pretty usually get my attention when the blood pressure is 70 or 80. And obviously you're kind of, you know, getting other people involved right away. But one important thing is that women that have ruptured ectopics, sometimes when there's blood in their belly, they actually exhibit a bradycardia. And this is thought to be due to the irritation of their peritoneum. And so just because they don't have a tachycardia or even with a bradycardia, you could be fooled into thinking that they're not really in shock. And so I think that's an important one.
Absolutely. And they'll also present with sometimes atypical complaints like shoulder pain, right? Referred pain from the diaphragmatic irritation. Well, the diaphragm gets irritated with all the blood in there.
That's right. That's called Kersine. You get a blood along the diaphragm and they complain of that classic shoulder pain. And, you know, just to be honest, there has been every single chief complaint in the book has been ascribed to ectopic pregnancy. I mean, the altered mental status, shortness of breath, chest pain, right? They've all been associated with ectopic.
It's true. And
so, you know, women of childbearing age get pregnancy tests in the emergency department because of our knowledge of this, of the fact that, you know, this could be the cause of a lot of different problems.
All right, their physical exam, I think here are the pearls, making sure that there's obviously no peritoneal signs. That'd be concerning for a ruptured ectopic. And then seeing if they have any localizing pain. A pelvic exam is an absolute must in all these patients. You're looking for the os. Is it open or closed? Can you feel the fundus? Can you sort of estimate how big the uterus might be and correlate that to any gestational size? Do they have any adnexal pain? Which brings us back to rule number two, which is that all pregnant women have an ectopic until proven otherwise. So how do we prove that otherwise? I think point of care ultrasound, like you mentioned, is so important and has really been a game changer for us. And this comes in, I think, right up front, even just in your initial assessment, as you're beginning to examine them, stick that probe on their belly and looking for free fluid. And
yeah, you know what? It's such a great point because when we first started doing ultrasound in emergency medicine, we started with the trauma examination, the focused assessment with sonography for trauma. Fast exam. And I think it's like among the easiest ultrasound exams you can do.
Yeah.
And I found the gyne stuff much more difficult, you know, especially
you gotta when get you get out the probe and
Nexa. And not to mention the probe care, you know. And the fact of the matter is that the most important thing in a pregnant woman in these circumstances is to make sure that there's not a positive fast exam, to make sure that she doesn't have free fluid in the belly that's in Morrison's pouch and around the bladder and in all the typical spaces that you look for in a trauma exam. And if they don't have free fluid, then they're probably not in shock from a ruptured ectopic and you can probably rest a little easier. And so bringing that ultrasound right up there into the primary survey really is what we do with these patients to find out, is there fast positive or negative, even before we do the gyne ultrasound.
That's right. And I'm going to stop right there because if that's positive and I know she's pregnant and there's free fluid in the belly, I'm done. The next thing I'm doing is calling OB. I mean, we'll talk about transfusion and all that stuff, but the main goal is to get that woman to the OR immediately, like literally do not pass go. Make that phone call and make it happen.
Now, Mies, you're still doing your physical. And so, you know, if you don't see free fluid, there are other things on your exam that are pretty red flaggy, right?
Yeah, red flaggy.
If they've got peritonitis,
exactly.
You're going to call the surgeon just the same the OBGYN or the surgeon. If they've got, you know, an incredibly tender mass on their nexa, that's going to, you know, obviously be something that you're going to want to get a consult for as well. But obviously the ultrasound comes right up there in the ABCDEs.
Yeah. And the physical exam is certainly important. The pelvic exam is still an absolute must in my opinion. And, you know, direct visualization versus direct digital exam, people always ask. I think it's important to take a look. You know, I stick a
Talk to us about that. There's no peritonitis. You've done your fast exam.
There's no free fluid.
There's no free fluid. The vital signs are reasonable. So you're going on to do your proper pelvic exam. You're going to look on the outside, make sure there's nothing in the vagina, nothing. You know, you're going to take a look at the whole picture before you zero in on the cervix, obviously.
Yeah.
And then when you reach the cervix and there's no obvious mass or something bleeding there, what is it that you're actually, you know, doing? Are you taking your finger?
I'll just say, well, I'll just stop you there, Stuart, because before I even do the pelvic, I bring around the whole gyne cart and I have everything ready to go. And what does that mean? I want a pair of ringed forceps. I want some sterile gauze. I want some lube, and I want as big of a speculum as I think the patient can tolerate, because I want a good visual field. And if it's really a lot of blood or anticipating a lot of blood, sometimes a Yanko or a suction catheter can help you. But with all that being said, if the patient's stable, yeah, do a direct visualization of the vaginal canal first. You're looking for lacerations. I mean, she could be pregnant, but she could also have a laceration along her vaginal mucosa from intercourse yesterday or right. today or whatever. So there could be other causes of bleeding. Then yeah, the money is at the os. And is the os open? Is it closed? Sometimes it's hard to tell. If this is their first pregnancy, their os is usually like a round pinpoint, right? The os, if it's closed, should look like a round circle in the middle. If they've been pregnant before, it's a slit. The cervical os is a slit face. Or a smiley yeah. face kind of yeah. looking thing. So,
or maybe it's a frown, actually, is what I think it really is.
Yeah, it's really bummed. Your uterus is
like, I don't want to do that again.
This really sucks. Yeah, right? Exactly. So sometimes it is admittedly hard to tell. Is it open? Is it closed? And that's where both, I think, the visual exam as well as a secondary digital exam is important. You want to get a sterile finger, a sterile glove up near the os and physically try and feel to see if it's open or closed.
Right. Okay. And a lot of the older sources and the way I was taught was actually to take rings forceps and insert them in the canal. And I really think that's fallen out of favor.
Yeah.
Between your visualization and your fingertip with the sterile glove, you really should be able to come to some sort of conclusion on whether or not the os is open or closed.
Yeah. I'll tell you where the ring forceps come in handy is
yeah.
when there's so much bleeding or clot in the way and you're trying to get to the os, you're trying to see the os, is using the ring forceps with a little bit of gauze to clean out the posterior canal, the posterior fornix.
And that, I was so glad you brought that up because, you know, there's so many times when you can make the patient feel better when they're in the midst of cramping and having this products of conception stuck in their cervical yeah. canal, and you take the ring forceps and you just gently help
pull it out
a yeah. little bit of that. Yeah. Help pull out a little bit of that stuff.
Yeah.
All of a sudden they can contract their uterus better, the cramping can get better, the bleeding can get better. And so there can be a really big therapeutic aspect to the vaginal exam as well.
Absolutely. And if there's POC actually stuck in the os and you see it, you bring up a really important point. You have to remove that. That will actually help the uterus clamp down and the cervix close back down and really help stop that bleeding. So I think the pelvic exam is still a must. At this point, Stuart, I think this is all happening simultaneously. We talk about these things like a 1, 2, 3, but I think these things are kind of all happening simultaneously. A point of care hemoglobin, if you have access to that, is important. And if you're thinking the patient might need a transfusion, this would be the time to be ordering blood, O negative versus type and screen blood if it's appropriate. So those patients with a positive FAST go straight to the OR. The other diagnosis that we initially talked about, those massive hemorrhages from the spontaneous abortions, those are the other patients that need to go straight to the OR. So those two diagnoses, ruptured ectopic and massive hemorrhage from spontaneous abortion, you need to get GYN on the phone, and all these patients need to go to the OR. If you have time to type and cross blood or at least get some O-neg hanging, that, you know, is sort of a nice icing on the cake, but the priority should be get those patients up to the OR.
So word on that. So Westphal and Jimmy had exactly the scenario, right? Lady comes in, she's bleeding a lot, she's in shock, in fact. So they're getting lines in, they're going to get her some blood, and then they're going to try and find out what's going on. So they found products of conception at the cervix and they've pulled them out. And most of the time, frankly, you don't need to go to the OR after that. That will stop the bleeding. And what we're talking about here in this scenario is if that doesn't stop, if your emergency intervention in the emergency department right there and then doesn't produce a rapid decline in bleeding, yes, they'll have to go up and get a DNC. Now, these people are going to come and get seen by OB anyway, and they might take them up for a DNC anyway. But remember, you don't have a person in your emergency department bleeding to death while you're waiting to call OB to do something that you might be able to fix in the emergency department. That is a good exam. Pull the products of conception out of the cervix if they're stuck there, and that can save a life. You don't wait the 30 minutes, the hour for the OBs to do that. You do that, and then you have a discussion about, okay, now do we need to do a DNC or something additional to that? That's what we're getting at. Of course, in the case of an ectopic pregnancy, where the person is exsanguinating, but they're doing it into their peritoneum, then you can't fix that. You cannot fix that in the emergency department because you do not have an operating room right there. You're not a surgeon. So that's a very different scenario. In that case, it's medical therapy. Give them replacement, give them blood, and call OB to come and take them to the OR, because that's not something that you can actually do anything about other than resuscitation. Is that clear?
Okay, so we've covered the basic first steps, the ABCs, and we've kind of identified the two populations that are going to go straight to the OR, those that are bleeding really badly on the outside and those that are bleeding really bad on the inside. And after we've kind of taken a breath and we've got a patient that's got reasonable vital signs, let's talk about the usual case here, the 99% of patients. And there's no huge hemoperitoneum seen on their fast examination. Their vitals are reasonably good. They're not soaking the entire bed with their bleeding pervaginum. And did you know that expression, by the way, pervaginum?
Pervaginum? I have to say, I've never heard that.
That's a British thing.
I was going to say, is that a Canadian thing? Is it a Canadian PV?
It means Palos Verdes in LA, but it's pervaginum in Canada.
Well, Jimmy, that was pretty exciting to say the least, but fortunately, she really slowed down after we removed the products of conception. But OB's admitting her, she's getting blood. The plan is a DNC, though there was some discussion about if she really needed it, but since she was in hemorrhagic shock, the thought was they better be sure she doesn't have another episode.
I assume that it's pretty rare to bleed that much. Tell me that is rare.
Yeah, I mean, that is basically the extreme end of the spectrum there. But let's talk about that. Let's assume she had much less bleeding and you had time to work her up and come up with a plan. What tests would you want to do after your initial, we assume, unremarkable exam except for a little vag bleeding, no masses, no abdominal tenderness?
Let's do a CBC and check platelets. I don't think you need bleeding tests. Let's also do an ultrasound to see where the pregnancy is and maybe a serum HCG.
So they're not hemorrhaging like the Dickens. Okay. What is your usual, what do you usually order on these patients?
So this is pretty standard. I mean, I think they all deserve a CBC. You want to know what their hemoglobin is, their hematocrit, and also their platelets. Type and screen, as well as an RH, is really important. You want to prevent any isoimmunization in the future. And then you really want a beta quant. That helps you not only now, but also in follow-up and trending that beta HCG level. It's important to have.
So quantitative beta HCG to get the actual number and...
To get the actual number, yep.
Then what about the pelvic ultrasound? In the terms of a first trimester bleed, it's pretty much indicated most of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. A formal ultrasound if they're stable enough. And then it is recommended that most patients get a urine culture, even if they're asymptomatic, mostly because we want to treat that.
It's an important point, actually. That's because of the huge role of urinary infections in complications.
Yep.
In all of pregnancy, but certainly in the first trimester, it's a huge cause of spontaneous abortion and even ascending infections sometimes. So yeah, that's important.
If you have a negative FAST on your point of care ultrasound, Stuart, that doesn't mean you're out of the woods quite yet with the unruptured ectopic, right? So you can have a pseudo-stable ectopic pregnancy. And some of the risk factors for ectopic, I think, are important to know. A patient with a previous history of ectopic pregnancy, so that's an important
one to ask.
Yeah. History of any tubal surgeries, that increases your risk by 9 times. That's pretty impressive. History of PID and also infertility. Being advanced maternal age, anyone over the age of 35 is considered a risk factor. Smoking, as well as current use of an IUD. So all of those are risk factors for having an ectopic.
Okay, so if those things are present, it's going to kind of change our decision-making as we go forward, but we're going to kind of keep that at the back of our mind that they might be slightly at a higher risk for ectopic. Okay.
So answer me this. Do you remember the concept of the discriminatory zone when it comes to ectopic pregnancies?
That would be no.
Well, look, it is Dr. Herbert. Wow, by some miracle, I might add, because, you know, he doesn't really get out too much. Dr. Herbert, can you give Jimmy the summary on this while I go see patients, since you're not seeing patients, or what are you, too old to see patients now?
Look, I'm on an extended sabbatical, not because of age, but because of a series of neuropsych issues that I'm not comfortable sharing in public. So rude, Dr. Westphal. Right, Jimmy, when it comes to ectopic pregnancy, different from the scenario you had this morning with Dr. Westphal, which was clearly an abortion of some form and the products of conception were stuck in the cervix and you had to fix it that way. When it comes to rule out ectopic pregnancy, I play a little game called Find the Fetus. So, first trimester, we know the lady's pregnant. Now we have to find the fetus to make sure that it's not ectopic. If I find the fetus in the uterus, or if I find the fetus outside the uterus, then I'm done, except under those rare circumstances that Mizuho talked about, where there could be the possibility that you have an ectopic and an intrauterine pregnancy at the same time. Very rare, except under the circumstances that she outlined, for example, people on fertility agents, fertility therapy. And a lot of those fertility therapies can be so profound that they actually get ultrasound very frequently, like weekly, sometimes twice a week, by their OBs to rule out that they're not having a heterotopic pregnancy. All right, so it's find the fetus. How do you find the fetus? Well, one way is like your patient this morning. There's some bleeding, you do an examination, and they've spontaneously passed the fetus, or the fetus is stuck in the cervix, and you pull it out, and you clearly see products of conception, not chunks of blood, but you clearly see a fetus. There is the fetus. We know it's not in the uterus anymore. We're done. It's not an ectopic pregnancy, except again under those extraordinary circumstances. The other way is obviously with ultrasound, that you put an ultrasound on and you see an intrauterine pregnancy, a full intrauterine pregnancy with a heartbeat, or with ultrasound findings that are very specific for intrauterine pregnancy, which we'll talk about. The concept of the discriminatory zone is that at a certain level of beta-HCG, serum beta-HCG, the fetus should be big enough for you to see it in the uterus. But if the beta is not very high, then that can be because the fetus is not very big yet, and so you wouldn't expect to see it, or it's an abnormal pregnancy, and it still could be an ectopic pregnancy. So the idea of this discriminatory zone is that there's a level of beta-HCG in the serum where you would expect to see a fetus within the uterus if it is a normal pregnancy. Below that discriminatory zone, you might not find a fetus in the uterus, but it could be there, or you could have an ectopic pregnancy. Here, let Stuart explain.
I can make it real simple for you, which is that, you know, this patient's going to get a quantitative beta HCG. The number is going to come back. And the bottom line is that the discriminatory zone is the number at which you should see something on the ultrasound to tell you that there's an intrauterine pregnancy. So if the discriminatory zone is quoted at 1500 in your hospital, in your radiology department, that means that they expect to see an intrauterine pregnancy by that level. So if it comes back at 2000 or 2500 and they don't see an intrauterine pregnancy, they start to really be concerned that there might be something ectopic.
I like that. I like how you simplified that, because I think the confusing part is when we start breaking it up by the number, the hormone number, and then the weeks of estimated gestational age, and then the ultrasound findings of gestational sac, yolk sac, embryo. It doesn't matter. You're right. It's an IUP or no IUP, and 1500 is really the number we're after.
The thing is that the real pitfall here, Mies, is that if the number is less than that discriminatory zone, sometimes people take that as a false reassurance that they don't need to worry about ectopic anymore, because it's like, well, we shouldn't see anything anyway in the uterus at that level. It comes back at 500 or 600 and, it's too early to really worry about it. And it's like, no, that's the point, is that so many ectopics rupture at levels lower than 1500 or 1200.
Which it doesn't make our job any easier.
No. So what does this mean? It means that you can't just consider the beta HCG level in isolation. Mm-hmm. You have to think about ectopic pregnancy in all levels of beta HCG. So it's the full clinical picture and the ultrasound and the risk factors that all have to come together to rule out ectopic, not just that one beta number.
That's right. And you bring up a really good point. You may not get the satisfaction of being able to rule out an ectopic, because if you have a number that's less than 1500 and you don't see an IUP, then that becomes a management question. And really the question is, if they're stable, how are you going to treat this? Usually, pretty typically, it's going to be a very close follow-up for a beta check. And you're going to give all these women a very strict return precaution if they start bleeding or start having some significant pain. But this is in concert with your gynecologist, you can speak to how you want to manage these patients, because they're certainly high risk.
Okay, so Mies, let's just make sure that everyone knows how to practically deal with this. We'll give a couple of different examples so that it's really clear. So for example, say I come in with vaginal bleeding and you do the initial workup and the ultrasound is basically showing nothing. There's nothing there. There's nothing in the uterus. They don't show any free fluid or anything that's suggestive of an ectopic pregnancy, which sometimes you can see on those ultrasounds. So it's important to look for it, but you don't see anything. And then the beta HCG comes back at 700. What would you do in that situation?
If you looked good and you were stable, then the repeat beta HCG in about 48 hours is important. And we say 48 hours because that hormone level should typically double. The beta quant should double within 48 hours for a typical normal pregnancy. If it plateaus, if it goes down, those are usually concerning signs for either a fetal demise or a potential ectopic.
Right. Okay. And so I think what you're really trying to say here is that until we convince ourselves that we see a pregnancy inside the uterus, we can't rest.
That's right.
And so if we see that their number is way too low, much under the discriminatory zone, we definitely have to continue to follow that out. And it only takes a few days because of what you say, it doubles every 2 days. And it only takes a few days until you will see something, if there is something to be seen on that ultrasound in the uterus. And yeah, you really, that period of time before you've confirmed that it's intrauterine, the patient, you have to know where they are. Where do they live?
Where are they going to follow up? Do they
have access to the hospital? Yeah. Do they understand that it still might be an ectopic until you've actually proven that something is in the uterus? And will they have easy access to get back to the hospital? That kind of stuff is really important. Okay, Mies. And then the other scenario would be if the beta is much higher than the discriminatory zone and you still see nothing on ultrasound, that starts to get a little more dicey because you really should see something by the time that beta is up to 1500, 2000 for sure. And so in that case, they might not do anything OB right away. They still might wait a couple of days and see if it doubles and check the ultrasound again. But you're starting to get into a higher risk situation where, you know, really you should be seeing a pregnancy. And if you don't, you have to assume that there's an ectopic there really heavily until proven otherwise.
And for completeness sake here, we should say that the discriminatory zone is in a bit of a trouble because there's also a lot of OBs have noted that they've often been pushed to do something. The beta is 3,000. There's nothing in the uterus. Somebody has some adenexal pain and they've given methotrexate. They've done a DNC. And there are cases, and not that few, where there is no fetus to be seen yet for technical reasons or whatever is going on, but it's actually an intrauterine pregnancy. So it can be wrong both ways. And so there is, in some circles, this turn away from the use of the discriminatory zone and just the use of ultrasound and even other tests. So it's not without controversy. What we're presenting here is a classic way that you would use beta HCG. You would use the discriminatory zone and a classic understanding of it. But understand within that, there's lots to be discussed with your OB colleagues about what to do in any individual patient.
So let's talk about management of the ectopic pregnancies that you may diagnose. Say you get an ultrasound, you do see a mass on one of the fallopian tubes. What do you do? How do you know whether it should be a surgical or medical management?
Well, by the time you start to see ectopic pregnancies, it actually becomes less and less likely that you'll just be able to manage them medically with methotrexate. So for example, if you see a fetus in a tube with cardiac activity, that's way too big to just trust methotrexate to. I mean, they could die in the process of waiting the methotrexate to work. It's just really too big. And so those are going to need to go to surgery. But if they have something that's small and the mother's otherwise in good health, she doesn't have anything that's making her immunocompromised, she can handle a drug like methotrexate, which is a pretty serious drug.
It is a pretty serious drug, yeah.
Then they can get methotrexate. And as long as you've got OB on board and supervising this whole process, and that's an important caveat.
Yeah, that's an important point.
Because they can have complications from this procedure, then it's probably reasonable if the beta HCG is less than, say, 5,000, you don't see a fetal heart, then it's okay to proceed with the methotrexate.